Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. The Brooklyn Queens Expressway is falling apart. Specifically, the 1.5-mile elevated stretch of the BQE that runs through Brooklyn Heights. The city's Department of Transportation is floating a pair of plans to overhaul the highway. One proposal would controversially result in the closure of the much-beloved Brooklyn Heights Promenade for 6 years. Not surprisingly, it's been met with a generous amount of pushback from local residents. We want to open the phones to you, to Brooklyn Heights residents, and anyone who may be affected by the potential closing of the promenade and the BQE repair plans. Our number is 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. We want to know how this will affect you and what you'd like the city to do. Are you a local who thinks the promenade with the views of New York waterfront and the Brooklyn Bridge, it's your refuge, your quiet place, and you need it? Do you have young children who use the promenade as an outdoor space? 212-433-9692. Brooklyn Heights residents, you need to call us. And non-residents, you can tell us what you think about this and what this means for your neighborhood. Public spaces define many places, and we want to know what the promenade and the thought of losing it for 6 years means to you. 212-433-9692. And by the way, if you don't like the plan to close the promenade, do you have a proposal of your own? We like solutions as well. 212-433-WNYC. We are going to be joined shortly by local city council member Stephen Levin, and he'll offer his thoughts and answer some of your questions. So write down that number again. But first, here to explain it all to us is WNYC transportation reporter Stephen Nesson. You've been covering the story, Stephen. You've actually gotten to go see the BQE. But first of all, how do we get to the point where 150,000 vehicles a day are driving over a stretch of roadway that is crumbling?
Well, let's go back to the 40s and 50s, if you don't mind.
Absolutely.
A little historical transportive journey. A developer named Robert Moses, who had a plan. He wanted to actually divert the BQE through the neighborhoods of Brooklyn Heights, Carroll Gardens. For him, that would be the fastest, most expedient way. And if you're a driver, it does appear that that would be a faster way to cut across Brooklyn rather than driving all the way around. But just like then and today, mm-hmm. NIMBYs, not in my backyard, folks. Nobody wants a highway running through their backyard, obviously. But Robert Moses, as being part of Parks Department as well as transportation, had the unusual advantage of taking what he needed to do what he needed to do. And in this case, it was putting the BQE around the Brooklyn Heights promenade. Well, it wasn't a promenade then, but around the water. He took some parkland to do that, and he got it done. People didn't. At the time, of course, people don't want this huge highway going through their backyard either. So they did this unique design called triple cantilever.
Which apparently is unique and strange and all that.
Exactly. It's actually only 8 blocks long. But if you've driven on the BQE going east or west, there's different layers, 3 of them, triple. And on the very top is a promenade where people can walk. It's actually quite lovely. People enjoy it. You know, it even contributed to that neighborhood getting its national historic landmark designation. It's, you know, a highlight of the neighborhood. So the BQE is right under there. It was built in 1954. It's actually that section that we're talking about, like you said, it's 1.5 miles. Yeah. It's actually made up of 21 separate bridges. And each bridge has joints and sections, and it's just rotting terribly.
All right. I understood you toured the underside. You actually got to see what the viaduct looked like. What did you see?
It was amazing. Like an amazing sight of destruction. It could have been the set for a horror film.
Oh, no.
First of all, let me just say, I'm walking.
I'm not laughing. I just like, you're very descriptive. Yeah, go ahead.
As a reporter, I'm looking up at this like exposed rebar. Rebar, you know, when you build a structure, you put the rebar, you pour the concrete, it's supposed to be covered. It's exposed. It's just like a grid of rusted brown rebar. It's dripping down. There's actually stalactites, which you may know from caves, but apparently concrete can turn into a stalactite when it's disintegrating.
Wow.
And part of the reason is, yes, you know, back when it was built in the 50s, they didn't have these heavy loads.
And they probably didn't expect it to have to be around for 50, 60 years.
I mean, I'm sure they didn't anticipate 150,000 cars a day, 15,000 trucks delivering to Target and all your Amazon orders and all this stuff. So it's falling apart. They can put it, they can fix it piecemeal, which is what they've done, so that we're not going to crash today, but soon. They actually have a time for it.
What is that? Because I was going to ask you, somebody right now who might be driving the BQE is like, what am I doing? It is safe, right? At the moment, they say?
City engineers are there constantly checking on it because pieces are falling apart. And they don't want to land on a car, obviously. But right now, the number, write it down, 2026. By 2026, the city's engineers estimate they will have to take heavy truck traffic off the BQE, that section, if it's not replaced. And if it's, I think you get another 10 years after that for all vehicles if something isn't done to replace it.
Wow. Okay, so we mentioned the city is proposing two possible plans to repair the viaduct. Can you walk us through the two plans?
I can do that. Let me just say the city is very much not a fan of the second way.
Okay.
Which is doing it piece by piece, a section at a time. This could take over 10 years easily.
Is it the time or the expense? Which seems to be the big tipping point?
It is a little bit of both, I would say. I think it's mostly the inconvenience to drivers, because if they have to close one section, a small fender bender will back up all of the BQE. So if you have a small section closed for part of the day, they just don't see it's a convenient way to do this sort of big project. Part of the other concern is safety. They don't know what they're going to find when they start taking out these pieces.
Oh, no. We've all heard those horror stories when people renovate homes, right?
So this is the version of replacing the BQE that the city is, I think, really in favor of. And that is the most controversial construction project since the L train shut down, I guess. And it will be going on for the next decade or more, is to build a 6-lane highway at the promenade level. So if you're walking on the promenade now and you're looking out at the beautiful view of the ocean, the Statue of Liberty, you can see Lower Manhattan, imagine that's just a 6-lane highway and you're not really going to be able to have those great views.
Wow. That's not a great visual, I have to say.
And the city says just to get that portion completed will take at least 2 years.
Oh, my gosh. So the DOT held a town hall in the neighborhood last week to present these two options. How did locals receive the news?
Oh, they were in favor. They love it. They say, please build a 6-lane highway
they
in my front yard.
Right? Yeah.
It was rancorous. A lot of anger, a lot of complaints. People don't want it. But at the same time, the DOT is really saying, we have to do something. We understand you don't like it. We have to do something. I think the city is planning to hold a lot of these kinds of events. That was the first of what's going to be dozens and dozens of meetings.
Yeah.
And they say they really do want to take the public's concerns into consideration. But they really want to build the 6-lane highway so they can work underneath it more quickly. If they do it underneath, they say they can get it done in, 6 to 8 years as opposed to, 10 or more.
Wow. Let's go to Nicole on line 10. Nicole is calling from Spain, but lives in the neighborhood. Hi. Hola.
Hi. Hola. I'm on a work trip here right now. I actually left about a week and a half ago, right before the DOT put out this PDF document about their proposal for the two options, the quote-unquote innovative one and the traditional one, which they clearly do not favor. And I have been freaking out the entire time. And so heard you were talking about this, wanted to call in.
So when you say freaking out, what comes to your mind when you first think about this?
So I guess the first thing is that the promenade is my favorite place, really, in the continental United States. I actually have a little, a necklace that I wear every day that has the New York City skyline on it that makes me think of being there. I wanted to live in Brooklyn Heights for easily a decade before I managed to buy a small fixer-upper there 2.5 years ago. The neighborhood and the promenade in general are such a respite. They're this place of peace. They're so iconic, historic, first historic district in the country, I believe. And, Washington slept there right before the Battle of Brooklyn and all these things. And I think about asthma and kids wanting to have a family, the devastating effect on local businesses. I just could easily see this being a situation that the neighborhood takes a generation or more to recover from, because no one's going to want to be there for that whole time if the promenade is an interstate. And my building abuts the promenade. I live on the other side of it, but I'm stunned that the Department of Transportation didn't make a bigger case for, didn't explain why they didn't repair this sooner and go through what is now Brooklyn Bridge Park, but was previously much less used and much less loved space. The whole thing is terrifying to me. I feel like I had this kind of dream come true situation, and now I don't know if we'll be able to, you know, start a family and do the things that we wanted to do over the next decade.
Nicole, thank you so much. You explained your fears and your freak out quite eloquently.
Could I ask Nicole a question?
Sure.
Does your building vibrate right now from traffic on the BQE?
Not that I'm aware of. I wouldn't doubt that maybe if you go down into the basement or the subfloor or the people who are on the nearer side of it do, but I never feel that on my side.
Why'd you ask that?
Because the city says another one of the reasons they really want to do this is that the wall that's holding up the Brooklyn Heights promenade is the same wall that's holding up the BQE. And so that's resulting in a lot of buildings along the promenade actually vibrating. And they're actively monitoring them for safety because there are so many vibrations from the BQE that's currently there because of the way it's currently built. And they're going to fix that going forward.
All right. Before I go to City Councilmember Levin, I want to ask you one more question. Where does the process go from here, Stephen?
Well, there's going to be what's called an environmental impact study that they're going to be working on next year. So hopefully the results will come out in 2019. And then there will be dozens after dozens after dozens of public meetings and hearings so the public can weigh in on this issue.
Okay, Stephen Nesson, thank you so much. You can weigh in right now as well, 212-433-WNYC. We have a lot of calls to get to, but we do want to hear from you. How is this going to impact you? What do you think the city should do about the crumbling BQE? If you're a local and you love that waterfront view, but you also like safety, what do you suggest that the city does? 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. We'll get to some of your calls in a moment. But right now, we're joined by City Councilmember Stephen Levin. His Western Brooklyn district includes Brooklyn Heights. He'll answer some of your questions. He'll answer some of my questions. So, Councilmember Levin, what's your read on the situation? Is this as dire as it sounds?
Hi, Allison. Thanks for having me on the show. I really appreciate it, and congratulations on the new show.
Thanks a bunch.
The situation is bad. It's really bad. This is a stretch of the BQE that is, as Stephen just described, kind of an engineering marvel in the sense of how it was built and this triple cantilever, but it's also like an engineering disaster because when it was built, it really wasn't built to be able to have meaningful ongoing maintenance. So like they don't have like doors that go back into the cantilever area. And a good way to kind of think about how this thing was built is it's kind of like an enclosed stepladder where the first step is the one lane going towards Staten Island. The next step is the other lane going towards Queens. And then the top step of the entire structure is the promenade itself. So one thing I think is important to note is that no matter which approach they take, they're going to have to close the promenade and rebuild it because the promenade is actually part of the cantilever structure. You know, we have Robert Moses to thank for the situation we're in right now. However, you know, there is both the city, the state, and the federal government all deserve, I think, a fair amount of blame for letting the deterioration happen as long as it has.
Yeah, I was going to ask, why are we at this point? Why are we having to have this kind of serious last-minute discussion?
Right. I mean, so, you know, 8 years ago or so, the State Department of Transportation was looking at ways to fix this, and they put that on ice. They shelved it. There was a plan in place, or there was a process of, you know, starting to plan it, and they shelved it, and they decided to not move forward. This was back in, like, 2011, 2012. And then in the meantime, the city and state together built out Brooklyn Bridge Park, and so you have, like, the new Pier 1 development, the hotel, and Pier House, mm-hmm. which is kind of on the northern part of where the kind of right past where the cantilever ends on the northern part. But then also the berms. This is the kind of the hills part of Brooklyn Bridge Park that block the sound from the BQE from going into the park. And all those things were built out over the last 7 or 8 years. And at the time, you know, a number of us were kind of saying, well, this is going to be a problem when they have to rebuild the BQE. And you know, when the city DOT started to really examine it, you know, what they came back with just in the last couple of years is, you know, this whole thing needs to be replaced. This is not even possible to, like, keep, like, it's not a maintenance job anymore. The whole thing needs to be replaced. Now, the initial cost that they estimated was about $1.7 billion. The cost that they're estimating now is closer to $3.5-4 billion. But one thing that I think is really notable, and I hope that this changes, is that that is all city dollars.
Wow.
Up to this point, the state has not pledged a single penny, nor has the federal government, to this project. So this is all city tax dollars that would have to pay for this. The state has not pledged a single penny. And that's really unusual. For a project like this, they normally chip in about a third, at least. And that's not what we're seeing here. And
so why aren't we seeing that, sir?
I have no idea. You know, it's a real problem, though. I mean, the state should be. I mean, it's a complicated structure because this is an interstate highway, but it's also both city and state have, you know, different jurisdictions. So one has the roadway, and you know, and part of the way that Moses was able to do all this stuff was because he had all of these positions. He was like the Triborough Bridge Authority and the City Parks Commissioner, and you know, he had like 8 different titles, and so he was able to get all this stuff done kind of unilaterally. But here we are. You know, it's no secret that the city and state, New York City, the mayor's office, the governor's office, don't see eye to eye on a lot of stuff, and I'm afraid that this is one of those you know, kind of collateral impacts of that, is
casualty
that
of it,
we're
yeah.
not having a lot of communication between the city and state. So that's kind of how we got here, and I definitely agree with all the things that Stephen put out there in his reporting. Go ahead.
I want to dive in because we've got somebody on line one, as happens on WNYC, who was involved with one of the studies that we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. Alan from Weston, Connecticut. Alan, come on into the conversation.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Of course.
Love your show, and congratulations for getting it. So my name's Alan Swerdlow. I'm a founding trustee of Brooklyn Bridge Park in the 1980s, actually. And it became obvious to us at a point in the mid-90s that there was a problem with the BQE. In fact, the state DOT came in, did a study, and said it immediately had to be removed and repaired. So I was teaching at Pratt Institute at the time, and it funded a study to look at an alternative, a tunnel, which would obviate the need to repair in place, do the work quietly underground, and cause minimum disruption, both economic and physical destruction to the neighborhood. I lived in that neighborhood at the time. The Pratt study was then cursory studied by the state DOT. They said it was feasible, but it was about $3 billion at that time, 1997. That study was covered by various news outlets and can be even seen today on the web through the New York Times website.
Mm-hmm.
So they came back in 2010, so that's about 13 years later, and said, oh, it's falling down. We immediately have to repair it. We're going to get together 20 community groups into something called a CAC. I participated on that as well. And the communities were given like 8 or 9 different options from which they chose a tunnel option only. That tunnel option was then expanded to 4 different possibilities or iterations. And the DOT, state DOT, studied it, said it was feasible, but dropped the idea. Now they come back, and they say it's immediately going to fall down, and we need to do this work immediately. Again, we hear this. And there's all the historic information from their studies and from other studies has been lost to time, and nobody seems to know anything about it. And the reason a tunnel, which, by the way, many tunnels have been built all over the world replacing aging infrastructure just like this. And the reason the tunnel option is the best alternative is that not only, as I said before, the physical issues of creating economic and physical hardship in the neighborhoods wouldn't be affected that much.
All right, Alan.
But it would save considerable amount of money over many years, similar to what happened in Boston. Boston's tunnel was brilliant, and it created a brand new city.
Alan, thank you so much. We're going to dive out because you're cutting out on us a little bit. Congressman Levin, I'm going to ask you to respond to Alan after a quick break. You're leaving to all of it. We'll be back after this break. You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. We're back on the line with Councilmember Stephen Levin. We're talking about the plans for how to repair the BQE. Councilmember Levin, right before the break, a gentleman from Connecticut named Alan called in and described a tunnel plan that was put forth. Have you heard of that before?
I have, yeah. For years, folks have been talking about the tunnel plan as a viable option. It has its challenges, for sure. One is how it could be disruptive in and of itself, building a tunnel. I mean, depending on where you would be building it, but if it was anywhere in the downtown Brooklyn area, I can imagine that being exceedingly difficult. The cost would probably be far in excess of the $3 or $4 billion that it was estimated 20 years ago, mm-hmm. and you know, it's probably double, if not triple, that now. And then Polly Trottenberg, who's our commissioner of transportation here in the city, addressed that at the hearing or the meeting the other day. And one of the challenges is that the city doesn't build tunnels. So city DOT has no experience doing this. And because the state DOT has basically, you know, washed their hands of this, and they dropped their, as I said, their plan 7 or 8 years ago, the city DOT, it's not really within their toolbox. Now, could they potentially do it? I think that it's worth exploring. And actually, that's one of the things that I would like them to explore, any and every option that might be available. So not just tunnel, but, you know, maybe going out into the East River, literally going around Brooklyn Bridge Park and building a temporary roadway that goes around Brooklyn Bridge Park, or using parts of Brooklyn Bridge Park that have been built. And that would be a shame, but, you know, the berm area that's been built over the last couple of years, if that's needed to do this in a way that's less impactful to the Brooklyn Heights neighborhood, I think that needs to be looked at seriously.
Let's go to Christina in Brooklyn Heights. She's been patiently waiting. She wants to dive in. Hi, Christina.
Hi, and thank you, Councilmember Levin, for
you.
Saying that.
Thanks,
I was at the DOT meeting, and I saw you speak, and I have to say you're a real leader for this community, and calling for alternatives to the six-lane promenade replacement plan, which would, you know, I mean, the promenade is a symbol of this community stepping up and preventing it being marred when the BQE was originally proposed. It's a testament to the community rising up and making it the first historic district. And so to look at underutilized spaces, we live with this park, which we love, see that it's always been under construction, and there are huge expanses where it can be used, and that can be a legacy structure in the park like the High Line is. You know, this promenade is the number one destination for tourists in New York. Somebody mentioned at the public meeting that it has a 5-star rating on Yelp. People love it and come from all over the world and use it in great numbers, I would say equal to the park, as a resident here who's always directing people on where to go when they get here. So it's of great relief to me as a community member, and I know the 1,600 people who signed the petition already, which just started last week, will agree that calling for the park to be considered, which it hadn't been. So it's a great relief to hear you say that, Council Member.
Yeah, absolutely. And I appreciate very much your comments and all the work that everyone's been doing to organize around this. And I think that this really has to be a community-driven process because, as you said, I mean, the promenade is a integral part of the Brooklyn Heights community. In fact, it's one of the only views in the entire city that's actually protected by zoning. So you can't build something to block the view from the promenade. It's actually in law as protected, and it's been that way for about 40 years. But yes, this has to be a community-driven process. We need to have all options on the table so that we can make a informed community decision. And it's really not, I think, appropriate for just DOT to come and say, here are two options. One is really bad, and the other one is extremely bad, and choose one. We have to have a kind of more meaningful dialogue moving forward.
Let's bring in Louise from Manhattan. Hi, Louise.
Hi.
What did you want to add?
Well, some of this argument about the park screams a little too much of NIMBY, like not in my backyard to me. Brooklyn Heights is a very small and very affluent neighborhood, and I know that that affords some level of power, and I certainly don't deny that the park offers a lot of benefits. But the entire city of New York depends on the BQE, and there are numerous parks surrounding the Brooklyn Heights neighborhood beyond the promenade, which is a very small section of parks compared to the Brooklyn Bridge Park below it or the lovely parks just across the bridge in Battery City and downtown New York that won't be affected by this construction at all. I think people are inflating it to sound like all of their green space will be taken away, but I don't think that's the case, and this construction sounds necessary, and so I think it should move forward.
Louise, thanks for calling in. I have a question for you, Councilman Levin, something that Christina brought up. Have there been any studies done about the economic impact of the neighborhood because it is such a tourist destination? I mean, if the promenade really is become something that is not that attractive and not that accessible for 6 years, what does that do to the ecosystem in the neighborhood, the financial ecosystem?
So they would probably have to look at that as they do their environmental impact statement, but I don't think that they've done anything approaching that yet. But I think if they were to move forward, they would have to do, and that would have to be in the environmental impact statement. But just keep in mind that if they do this, the promenade will be gone. It will be actually temporarily for that period of time during the construction will actually be converted into basically this six-lane highway. So it'll actually disappear for that time. Now, DOT has said that when they rebuild it, it'll be bigger and better, and there'll be more open space. And as they presented it, from an engineering perspective, I kind of understand where they're going in that it does allow for improvements to the BQE, approaches to the bridges, both the Brooklyn Bridge and the Manhattan Bridge. So there'll be new ways of getting on and off the Brooklyn and Manhattan Bridge if they were to use, the quote-unquote innovative approach.
We have a question. Will the two small playgrounds, Pierpont and Walt Whitman, will they be closed altogether if this happens?
I don't think that they would be closed altogether, though they might have to be. Pierpont goes right up against the promenade, so it might have to be closed temporarily. But the Chapin Playground, which is a little bit further north, is actually part of the Columbia Heights structure that would actually have to be demoed entirely, and probably under any scenario will have to be demoed and then replaced. Keep in mind, as I said, this would all under any scenario be temporary. So in the long run, so 10 or 15 years down the line when the whole project is finished, everything would either be replaced in kind or better.
I have a question for you finally, the last question. Often decisions are made because of financial concerns, of course. Is there an answer that's just hugely expensive, but it's the right answer, something that would not have such a big impact on in the neighborhood, something that would not be as invasive, but it just costs a ton?
That's a great question. I think I've asked them to explore anything. So maybe literally even diverting the roadway to go out across, like over like over the East River. The problem, as they presented it from an engineering perspective, is that that involves a lot of turns, kind of like 90-degree turns, that would have a big impact on traffic flow. So from I can see how they want to do the innovative approach. It's kind of like I looked at it. It's like an IKEA approach. It's kind of easy. It's almost. It would take a very short time to construct it. It's a kind of temporary structure that would eventually come down, or most of it would come down, and it's very it's very functional, but it really does not take into account what the impact would be on the neighborhood, which is in some cases we're talking 15 feet away. I mean, people's apartments on Columbia Heights would be really, you know, a very, very short distance from that six-lane highway, and that's the type of impact would just be massive. And that's why, you know, over the years when we've thought about these things, often we come up with compromises because you know, it's not just NIMBYism. It's, you know, I don't want a six-lane highway 15 feet from my bedroom window, and that's an understandable position.
And we'll take one last call, Barry from Queens. Hi, Barry.
How are you doing?
I'm well. What do you have to say?
Well, I'm a lay person, so I have two questions in mind. What about what does this do for the average working person in the community? This highway will bring a lot of income to carpenters and people working. I mean, and we could build it safer and better. Now, if you have a one person lose their life as a result of something falling, the $3.5 billion that you're talking about there, a life is really worth more than any of that. If it's crumbling, yeah, and then you have earthquakes in New York from time to time, any one of these things could trigger you know, something bigger that caused problem on this highway. So let's build it and have a compromise like they're saying, and hope that everybody, the engineers and everybody, could be happy and build safer and better, and everybody, the whole city will benefit from it. You have, you know, a whole mosaic of people that pass through New York and the surrounding areas that live in Brooklyn. It's not only the people, the affluent people that live around the promenade will benefit from this. The whole city will. So why don't we build safer, and we have people that can. I'm a carpenter. I've been with the New York City District Council of Carpenters, and I know that we could build this thing and build it bigger and better for all of
for
us.
For everybody.
For my children.
Barry, thank you so much. Barry had the kumbaya moment. Councilman Levin, one quick last word from you on this.
Well, I think that Barry's right. I think that we have to do this. We don't have a choice. If we don't do something now, we're going to, within 20 years, we literally have to close the BQE. We can't be in that position, obviously, because the BQE, it's an interstate highway, and it connects, you know, it connects the eastern seaboard. It goes from, you know, from New Jersey through Staten Island up through Queens, the Triborough Bridge, and, you know, out into Connecticut and upstate New York. I mean, you can't have this fall into a worse state of disrepair. So we do have to do something. I think that we need to figure out a way where we're able to do it in a way that is cost effective. We now have this design build concept of state authorization, so it will be cheaper and it will take less time. But we have to do it in a way that is respectful of the surrounding community and is achieving our major objectives, while not putting out the rest of the eastern seaboard by having to close it down, you know, for significant stretches of time. So
that is a tall order.
This is what we're supposed to do in government, is try to figure out these tough questions.
City Councilmember Stephen Levin, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks a lot, Allison. Take care.
listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. And for the past week, filmmakers, actors, and film lovers have come together at Lincoln Center to partake in the 56th annual New York Film Festival. All week, we've brought you conversations with artists who've premiered films at this year's festival, and we'll have more from our series next week. As the festival goes into week two, two of the festival's programmers are here to tell us about the events and screenings we can look forward to. Dennis Lim and Florence Almonzini. Did I say it right, Florence?
Yes, you did.
Welcome to All of It. So this week, we talked to Paul Dano about his film Wildlife, Olivia Assayas about nonfiction. Catherine Hahn was here yesterday about Private Life. What are some of the big films next week?
Well, we have a whole week to go. actually, a little more than a week. We have our centerpiece film tomorrow night is Alfonso Cuarón's Roma, which is his first film made in Mexico since Y Tu Mama También. And I think it's, you know, Cuarón has I think in his last couple of films proved himself to be a really a master of like the epic films like Gravity and Children of Men. And this one is a film that is kind of an epic of the everyday. It returns to a much smaller scale, but incredibly impressive. And we're excited about that. And we also have, kicking off tonight, we have a section called Projections, which is devoted to experimental work, and that runs for 4 days through Sunday.
That's kind of exciting. Florence, tell us about the special screening of The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse.
Oh, so we, outside of the main slate and all this exciting new film coming up, we also try to explore the history of cinema. So in a special event, we are doing a silent film called The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, directed by Rex Ingram. It's a great silent film from 1991 that really launched Rodolphe Valentino's career. So we managed to get an amazing, beautiful archival print from collector Martin Scorsese. Thank you, Marty. Oh. And we have a live accompaniment, which is electro rock with a band coming from Ireland that include a member of the Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, Barry Adamson. So it's edgy, but it's also you explore cinema and you make it contemporary. There's an amazing tango scene in the middle where Rodolphe Valentino is dancing around with this electro sound. It's just amazing. So that's one, for me, a personal highlight outside of all the other great films you just mentioned.
So exciting. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Alfonso Cuarón. That's a name that people know, obviously, from Gravity. Are there any filmmakers, more emerging filmmakers that you think, or maybe people who aren't necessarily household names unless you're a cinephile, that you are excited about?
Yeah. Well, I would point to the film that we're opening projections with tonight. It's called Diamantino. It's a collaboration between two very interesting young filmmakers, Gabriel Abrantes and Daniel Schmidt. Even though this is an experimental section, we put in all kinds of films, and there are narrative films, documentaries, short works. This film is about a very good-looking but not very bright soccer star who blows it at a big match.
From Portugal?
From Portugal, possibly based on
someone.
famous. maybe we're not allowed to say that. And then it just proceeds from there with like a lot of pretty crazy subplots involving like gender identity and genetic engineering and the refugee crisis. It's sort of like if you can imagine like a sort of John Waters take on Zoolander or something like that, but crazier.
Wow, that just blew my mind. John Waters meets Zoolander.
So yeah, I'd recommend that highly. We're showing it tonight and tomorrow.
And also, you know, I know there are a lot of Q&As that are done at the festival. Has there been any news broken or any Q&A you think was particularly interesting or one that you were involved with?
Well, I mean, let's see. Oh. We had a very interesting press conference with Claire Denis a couple of days ago. This is the second screening of her film tonight, High Life. I mean, that one got a lot of attention because it stars Robert Pattinson, mm-hmm. who was there. They talked about their relationship, how he was the one who actually pursued her to get this role. And you know, he's obviously been an actor who's made a lot of interesting choices mm-hmm. recently. So that got a lot of attention.
Mm-hmm. What else?
I did a Q&A for Wildlife with Paul Dano and Carey Mulligan, which mm-hmm. was, I wouldn't say controversial, but some of the members of the audience were questioning how unlikable her character was in the film for being, you know, what we would say, like an unfit mother and mm-hmm. wife. And that was the audience, and they responded really well to that semi-attack and explained why women don't have to be perfect on screen and in life, and you can sympathize with a character who's not just absolutely a perfect mother, as you know, drinking problem maybe. So that was pretty interesting to deal with this on stage and in the moment where people are not prepared for, you know, something so sudden.
And what are the other Q&As coming up?
Well, we have Q&As with, I would say, almost every filmmaker is attending. We have this weekend a young filmmaker we're very excited about named Alice Rovarkar. She's only made three films. We've shown all of them in the festival. This is called Happy as Lazaro. Actually, Scorsese, Florence just mentioned, Marty Scorsese has just come on as an executive producer of this film. I think she's one of the most exciting filmmakers of her generation. This film won a prize in Cannes. It's a film, I don't really want to give too much away because it takes a very unexpected twist midway, and I think the less you know going in, the better, but it's a film that deals with serious social issues in Italy, but you know, inequality and people living on the margins of society. But it does it in a kind of almost like mythic, like fairy tale register.
They've given us five or six films to think about. I know you have five and six screens going, so there's so much more going on. The New York Film Festival runs through October 14th, right, at Lincoln Center. Dennis and Florence, thank you so much for joining us. Come up. Do you know how much money a professional cheerleader makes? When you crunch the numbers, it can be little as $2.75 an hour. We'll talk about a petition that's aiming to help these women make a living wage. This is All of It. We'll be back after a quick break. This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart, and it's time to talk about petitions. I love online petitions. I actually love that someone cares so much about an issue that he, she, they take time out to rally support and make a difference in the world, fighting the good fight, no matter how significant or quixotic, you know, all of it. Today, we're checking in on a petition aimed at the living wage in a surprising way. We should note WNYC does not necessarily endorse the petitions that we choose to highlight. We merely want to share the story of engaged citizens. Today, we're taking a look at a petition that currently has 164,057 signatures. A few people just signed it yesterday, and the petition is called Roger Goodell, NFL Commissioner, Petition to Provide NFL Cheerleaders with a Livable Salary. Diane Todd is the petitioner, and she petitioned not only Mr. Goodell, she also names 23 owners of professional football teams, including the owner of the New York Jet. Diane Todd joins me now by phone. Hi, Diane.
Hello, Allison. Thank you so much for having me.
Could you please read the first paragraph of your petition?
It would be my pleasure. NFL cheerleaders are one of the most recognizable mainstays of the sport, rooting on their teams in extreme weather and performing routines for millions of fans. But while NFL cheerleaders bring in as much as $1 million each season for their teams and merchandising and promotions, many get paid as little as $150 per game.
$150. How did you learn this? How do you know this?
So 5 years ago, I've had this petition going for the last 5 years, by the way. I was at a middle school football game cheering on my daughter. I'm actually designated as the cheerleader for the cheerleaders. While she was going ahead and cheering for her team, those of us parents in the stands were like, well, I wonder how much our daughters will make as NFL cheerleaders. And we went ahead and Googled that, and I found out they were making minimum wage or less, and that was 5 years ago. I became appalled at that, went ahead and found change.org, not knowing anything about petitions, went ahead and launched this petition, and 5 years later, it's still going.
So why do you think you have over 160,000 signatures?
Well, I think that, you know, this is one of those where cheerleaders are, there's a lot of cheerleaders, let me tell you. I go to cheerleading competitions, and the competitions are full of competitive cheerleaders. There's lots of cheerleaders. They're in middle school, high school, just like football players. So there's a lot of fans that are following cheerleaders. It's very popular. It is now a sport in California. I was involved in getting AB 202 approved, so it is now officially a sport in California. I believe it was also going for New York as well. So there's a big following on this.
And I should note that, you know, sometimes feminists don't particularly care for cheerleading, but I should point out that last year's Super Bowl teams, the cheerleaders included nurses, teachers, an accountant, a physician's assistant, a physical therapist, an engineer, a Harvard grad student, and a councilwoman from New Jersey. So there are a lot of different kinds of women who are involved in this. My question is, if it's part-time. It's not their full-time job. That's what the NFL says. They said, you know what? This is something that they do for the love of it.
Well, just because you love doing something doesn't mean you shouldn't get paid for it. I mean, I assume you love doing your job, but you like the paycheck as well. So, yeah, I don't know what else to say about that. I mean, I think the whole crutch of the issue is that cheerleaders are, you know, they're in middle school, they're going all the way up the ladder. And when you get past college, there's no career path. It's limited. So you either go into the NFL if you love cheerleading, and that's what these women do. They love cheerleading. They've been doing it since they were, you know, way little. So they go to the NBA, they go to the NFL, and this is what, you know, their career path is. That's it.
Have you heard from any of the team owners?
None of the team owners. All of them just basically seem to wait around for lawsuits to happen.
All right. Well, this is to be continued. Diane Todd, thank you so much for sharing your story and your petition.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Sure. Well, Diane started this 5 years ago, but this story has grown and grown and expanded. The New York Times has been in the forefront on covering scandals among NFL teams and their cheerleading squads. Along the way, Times reporters have uncovered restrictive team rules on etiquette, social media, required topless photo shoots, rampant harassment from fans and staff alike. Juliette Mazur has been covering cheerleading for the past year from the Times. She joins us now. What do you think is really behind? What made you decide to examine this corner of pro sports, Juliet?
Well, that's a good question. We started doing this a few years ago probably about a year and a half ago when the first, the most recent lawsuits, wave of lawsuits came out when Bailey Davis, a former cheerleader for the New Orleans Saints, had complained about getting fired for posting something, a picture of herself on Instagram and supposedly fraternizing with the players in a restaurant where if a player comes in, the cheerleaders have to leave. So she was supposedly at a party with some football players and had posted this picture of herself on Instagram and was fired and filed a complaint about it. So we started writing about it because of that, and it's really grown. There's been a few more lawsuits, one with the Houston Texans, one with the Dallas Cowboys, one with the Miami Dolphins, for all different kinds of things, including discrimination, harassment, religious discrimination. So it's an issue that really, it does have something to do with cheerleading because that's the topic, but it really has to do with workers' rights and women's rights.
How does the NFL justify not paying these cheerleaders a decent wage?
Well, the NFL... Yeah, the NFL really is taking the stance where they're saying we have nothing to do with the cheerleaders. Not all of our teams have cheerleaders, so it's not a league-wide issue. The teams themselves are in charge, so the NFL is sort of looking the other way while these cheerleaders aren't getting paid very much. You know, they're getting away with it because they have been able to do it in the past, and it hasn't been an issue. No one's complained about it until recently. So I think... Another issue is that a lot of these women feel like very lucky to make the team. Sometimes there's hundreds of women who try out, and every day once they make the team director says they should really be lucky to be here. You know, they could be replaced in a moment. This is something that most team directors seem to harp on all the cheerleaders at every single team. So they're afraid to speak up about their rights because they think they will get fired.
Yeah, Diane told us off mic that it's hard for cheerleaders to come forward and shed their anonymity. What did you find during your reporting?
Well, that's true because they don't want to lose their jobs. Any sort of complaints, and you know, this is like I said before, it's not just cheerleading. This is almost any job. You could say people are afraid to come forward, right? If they don't have a place where they could safely complain about discrimination and not fear recrimination for it. The cheerleading issue is certainly a place where that happens. They're afraid to come forward even after they leave the sport because a lot of their really good friends are in cheerleading or in the NFL cheerleaders. They've grown the big social circle with that, and sort of have a status still that remains as a former NFL cheerleader. Some people are still work in the industry, whether it's with fitness or dance or makeup or hair and things like that. And I know Diane said a lot of these people have been cheering since they were young, but in the NFL, they might have cheered on their high school football cheerleading team, but really they're dancers. They've been dancing since, you know, some of them since they were toddlers, and they are they've gone to dance competitions their whole life. So they're professional dancers. They're not just it's sort of a different type of cheerleading. It's in fact not cheerleading at all. It's more professional dancing. So and there are a bunch of people in the league who are doctors, who are lawyers, and like you said before, they really run the gamut. But from my perspective, let's just say they're all professional dancers. You know, they're not doctors, they're not lawyers, they're not working for their state senator. You know, if they're all professional dancers, I think that they deserve to be paid a fair wage also, even if they're not of these other in these other careers that you mentioned.
And Julie, quickly, about 20 seconds, what is something that could change things for the better for cheerleaders?
Well, the NFL has to take responsibility and to mandate rules and regulations for each team and make sure that they follow them, including a pay raise, including a way for people to report harassment safely. The NFL has the power to do that with all these teams, and they need to take responsibility because the teams have shown that they can't do it themselves.
Yeah, Juliette Mazur from the New York Times, thank you so much for sharing your reporting. This is All of It. We'll be back after the news.